Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this, the latest edition of the OIS podcast series. My name is David Ledesma. I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the OIS, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Jim Henderson, who's Director of Energy Transition at the OIS. Now, for the month of October 2022, we're doing something a bit different. The OIS is running a series of podcasts focused on COP27 and the issues that are likely to be faced at the conference that is being held between the 6th and the 18th of November in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt.
Each podcast will consist of a number of interviews with authors of the articles in the OIS Oxford Energy Forum number 33, which is called COP27, Refocusing the World on the Energy Transition Agenda. This is going to be published in October 2022. David and myself will both be doing the interviews, and we hope you enjoy listening to them.
This fifth podcast will talk about the breakthrough agenda that was announced at COP26. Golf Geelan will discuss this agenda and clean technology. Martin Lambert will address hydrogen and the future of green gases. And Reza Madahi, the importance of CCUS, BECCS and DACCS technologies.
Okay, now we're going to talk to Dolph Geelan from IRENA about his article on the breakthrough agenda. Dolph, welcome to the podcast. I wonder if we could start, if you could just explain or indeed remind us what the breakthrough agenda was that was signed at COP26 and what its major goals are.
Yeah, thank you very much, James. Pleasure to be here. The breakthrough agenda, it was an agreement of about 45 world leaders to push through some key innovations in a number of areas, and that includes four energy areas. So the power sector transformation, the steel sector, it includes also hydrogen, and the transformation of road transportation.
Okay. Well, I wonder if you could tell us then what progress has been made in each of those key sectors that you focused on in the article.
Yeah, so IRENA, together with the IEA and the high-level champions, UN Climate Change high-level champions, assessed at what is the status of the transition in these four sectors and what needs to be done to create the right enabling framework to accelerate these. And so power sector, we have at the moment around 3 terawatts of renewable power. We need around 8 to 10 terawatts by 2030. And for that, we need to accelerate renewables deployment by a factor of 3 to 4 every year in this decade. For hydrogen, at the moment, we have 1 to 2 million tons of clean hydrogen production every year. We need by 2030 around 150 million tons clean hydrogen production. So that is roughly 75 times more. For green steel, we have at the moment less than 1 million ton production a year. We need around 100 million tons by 2030, 100 times more. And EVs, of course, is the area where we see most progress. We have gone from 10 million EVs this year. We need to go to around 40 million, 50 million EVs by 2030, so a factor 4 to 5 increase. So in all these sectors, we have a challenge.
Indeed. And so what do you expect in terms of kind of heading towards those goals and meeting those challenges? What do you expect to achieve at COP27? Is that going to be a major forum for making progress on those goals?
Well, so I think so. What we've done so far in the course of this year is really pinpoint what is the challenge and what can be done with more international collaboration. So that is broken down into a number of key areas. Of course, there is some area of where there's still R&D is needed, but we have most technologies. It's mostly about deployment. And if you take the example of hydrogen, for example, what's important there is to develop international standards and certification systems for clean and green hydrogen to allow international trade. And there are similar issues in some of these other areas.
So I guess, what exactly are you going to be discussing at COP27? Are you going to be bringing together the countries that have signed the breakthrough agenda? Are you hoping to add more countries to the list? What's the main goal for the COP?
Exactly. So continue to expand the list. There's also thinking whether the number of topics needs to be expanded further, so other sectors, other hard to decarbonize sectors. It's also clear that there is a need for public-private partnerships in a lot of these transitions. So bringing in the private sector into this discussion will also be at the agenda. And I said that there's a number of areas identified and a number of gaps identified in today's international framework. For example, in the steel sector, there are some gaps. So filling these gaps will also be on the agenda.
And are there any major challenges that you see in terms of either the negotiations at COP or indeed in any of those five sectors? Where do you see the key challenges, if you like, at COP and beyond?
Well, it's really critical that as many of the key countries as possible participate in this effort. So to give you one example, if you talk steel production, there's one country, China, which accounts for more than half of the world's steel production. So it's critical that China becomes part of this international discussion and international effort to mitigate emissions in steelmaking. And if you talk about the road transport, so we're talking electromobility as a key solution. But to make that electromobility grow, you need critical materials and you need to de-risk and make sure that there is sufficient of these critical materials available. Again, an area that requires international collaboration.
I mean, talking of collaboration, that is one of the key themes of the COP. Obviously, there is some fairly interesting geopolitics going on at the moment. Do you think this COP can achieve levels of collaboration around environmental issues, or do you think that there's going to be too many distractions?
Well, it's a COP in Egypt. I think the fact that it's in the MENA region is interesting and offers specific opportunities. Being linked to the Middle East, being linked to Africa, both critical parties in this global transition. There is a lot of talk, for example, about hydrogen at the moment. So I expect quite some significant announcements in that area. And let's see what happens with also the just energy transition roadmaps.
It's interesting you bring that up, because I was going to say, I mean, in terms of the agenda and the countries you want to get involved, I think this COP's going to be quite a focus on the developing world and what can be done to support the transition there. How does the breakthrough agenda sort of address the issue of the need for support for the developing world?
Well, the need for investments and for financing is clearly identified as one of the priority areas, as well as the need to de-risk some of these efforts. So, for example, if you want to sell green steel at the moment, and there is significant opportunity in developing countries to produce that, you need to have some secure demand to get these projects off the ground, because we're talking investments of billions of dollars. So creating that demand is a role then for the developed countries to allow these investments to happen in developing countries. So it's one example of an area that requires attention.
So do you see significant opportunity then for enhanced trade relationships? I mean, I'm thinking particularly if you go back to hydrogen, the potential for hydrogen exports from the Middle East, from Africa to demand centers in Europe. Is that something that you see with having significant potential for, you know, collaboration, if you like?
Absolutely. Probably not hydrogen trade by itself, but hydrogen in the form of ammonia trade. And we see tremendous progress in that area.
And in other areas, so in areas like EVs, for example, How do you see the developing world playing a role there? Is it about providing the technology to allow EVs to develop in the developing world, or is it about manufacture? How do you see the role there?
Well, there is a need for significant growth in critical material supplies, such as lithium. You see now a lot of activity also in development of new lithium mines, for example, in Africa, but also elsewhere. And there is a lot of efforts going on now to also go further down in that value chain and to use these materials to make battery materials or even to produce batteries and EVs. For example, in South Africa, there's no attention for that. So you see that countries are developing countries are trying to gain a significant share of that value chain. And then, of course, as you say, I mean, there's also a need to develop the charging infrastructure to start EV sales in the developing world.
Okay, I mean, one last question for you then. As we talk through all these challenges, what would you see as a successful outcome from COP27 for the breakthrough agenda? What are you most hoping to achieve?
That the countries take the recommendations from our report on board and fill the gaps that we have identified, that more countries join, and that this effort is expanded also to other hard-to-decarbonize sectors.
Okay, Dolf, thank you very much indeed. That was a very nice summary of your excellent article in the Oxford Energy Forum. Thank you for speaking to us today and indeed for writing the article. And we hope to be in touch again soon. We're now going to talk to Martin Lambert about his article in the forum, which is around green gases and hydrogen and their role in the COP negotiations. Martin, welcome to the podcast again. And let me start by asking you whether you think that the Russia-Ukraine war and perceptions of natural gas have had a positive impact on perceptions of alternative green gases.
Yes, thanks, Jim. Nice to be back on the podcast again. In terms of green gases, perhaps first of all, just important to say what we mean by them. And in the article and so in this podcast, are we talking about both biomethane and what I call clean hydrogen? So that's low carbon hydrogen from natural gas or renewable hydrogen from electrolysis. And so I'll cover both of those. In terms of perceptions, on biomethane first, if you'd asked me a year ago, I'd have said biomethane had dropped down the agenda and policymakers had kind of forgotten about it in favour of hydrogen. But actually, post the invasion of Ukraine and the desire to shift away from Russian natural gas, biomethane, particularly in Europe, has shot up the policy agenda with very bold ambitions for 35 BCM of biomethane by 2030. Which is a huge amount, and then on hydrogen, 20 million tonnes. So I'd say, certainly in the medium term, renewable gases have really shot up the agenda following the invasion.
Okay, well, you've mentioned hydrogen there, and there's obviously been a lot of talk, particularly in Europe, but also around the world, about hydrogen strategies. Has any real progress been made since COP26? And is the preference now very much in favour of renewable rather than low carbon hydrogen, given the need for natural gas in the latter?
Well, it's a great question, actually, because you're wondering about strategies. It's really easy to publish strategies. You can write a nice glossy booklet and say, here's our hydrogen strategy. But it's much harder to get projects to a final investment decision and start construction. In fact, it's interesting. So just in the last few days, the IEA have published their latest global hydrogen review, which I peer-reviewed a couple of months ago. And when I peer-reviewed it, they were referring to their database. And said, oh, it's all great news. We've got lots of projects have been announced. There's lots going to happen in hydrogen. And if that happened globally, they could get to 16 to 24 million tonnes of hydrogen a year by 2030. But I pointed out to them, and I'm glad to see they picked it up, that there's a world of difference between announcing a project, so you can call it a PowerPoint project, and getting it to FID. And in fact, the one they published, they pointed out only 4% of projects in the pipeline have actually got to FID. So there's a very long way to go. And yeah, that's not so surprising. if you look back at the history of LNG projects, I always had a rule of thumb that probably about one in five projects might come to fruition. And, you know, look at Canada with many LNG export schemes, only one got off the ground. For hydrogen, I guess the number is a lot lower. So if the IEA's got 16, 24 million tonnes in their database, probably by 2030, getting to 3 to 5 million tonnes globally could be more realistic. And on part two of your question about gas versus renewables, so I think you're right. In Europe, at least, anything with more natural gas demand is not good. And so the focus is very much, Europe's always been more focused on renewable gas than on renewable hydrogen rather than hydrogen from natural gas. But actually, this is even more sort of convincing that, yeah, we definitely want to have a hydrogen from renewable power. But having said that, CCS is still pretty important as part of the net zero package, and particularly in the Middle East and North America, I think we'll carry on seeing blue hydrogen, so from natural gas with CCS, being an important part of the story.
Okay, well, let's come back to biogas, biomethane particularly, which you mentioned earlier being now more popular in Europe. I mean, historically, it's suffered from cost issues, certainly relative to natural gas. But I guess with the high price of natural gas now, I presume they're becoming more attractive. I mean, you've talked a little bit about Europe. Maybe you could expand a bit on that in terms of the practicalities of expanding production. But what also about the rest of the world?
So biomethane is still more expensive than the historic natural gas prices. So biomethane costs are around $15 to $25 a million BTU or 50 to 80 euros a megawatt hour. But it's now much cheaper than low-carbon hydrogen, and certainly with European gas prices way above 100 euros a megawatt hour, it's much cheaper than natural gas. I guess the snag for investors, though, is to have confidence that gas prices will stay being that high. And so my suggestion in the article is that European policymakers should be offering contracts for difference, which would then be a real incentive to investors to build biomethane plants and give confidence about a future revenue stream. And with that, I think the ambition for 35 BCM of biomethane by 2030, that could be achievable. But I think we do need some policymaker action to make it happen. You asked about the rest of the world. And so I think because COP27 is the Africa COP being in Egypt, again, I highlight in the article that you can look at biogas, biomethane in an African context. It's a bit different there, I think, because it's about using biogas either as a clean cooking fuel or for power generation to complement intermittent renewables. And the IEA reckons that there's about 15 million tonnes of oil equivalent, which is quite a big chunk in the African context, and all that's available within Africa for those objectives of clean cooking or for power generation.
Okay, so you've mentioned the COP and its location. I mean, are you expecting discussion about green gases to play a major role at COP27? I mean, historically, the mention of any form of gas other than hydrogen has not really gone down well at the COPs. But so what outcome do you think we can expect in terms of specific plans and objectives? Might we see some actual agreements signed?
Possibly, but of course, COP is such a wide-ranging set of discussions. I mean, I commented in the article that even at COP26 and even with the excitement around hydrogen, hydrogen didn't really feature much in any of the sort of high-level communications around COP, and there weren't really any substantial agreements. But I think with COP27 being the Africa COP, we might see some agreements about collaboration between the rich world and the developing world. And that could, for example, help with getting biogas going at scale in Africa, so in that clean cooking and power generation they talked about. And also maybe for hydrogen, I can see a potential for deals along the lines of Europe wants more clean hydrogen, so they want to build more renewable power in somewhere like Morocco. But the snag with Morocco is it burns lots of coal for power generation. So quite a plausible deal, I think, could be something along the lines of a country like Morocco could say, well, Europe, you come and build us more renewable power, and we'll use some of that ourselves to decarbonize at home, and you can use some of that to make green hydrogen to export to Europe. So, and I think that's what kind of parallels with some of the sort of oil development deals done in the past, that yes, you can develop your oil and natural gas in our country, but you need to do something for our country too while you're doing that. So that would be quite an interesting renewables variation on the theme of how energy markets have been developed in the past.
Okay, Martin, thanks. Yeah, that's a very interesting, actually, kind of element of collaboration. Of course, collaboration is one of the main themes that the Egyptian presidency have put out for COP27. So it'll be interesting to see whether there can be collaboration around green gases, as you described. Well, look, thanks very much for the interview and also for your very interesting article in the OEF, which, of course, can be found on our website. But for the time being, thanks very much.
Now we're welcoming Reza Madahi to the podcast, and he's going to talk about his article in the OEF, CCUS, BECCS, and DACCS technologies. Reza, it's great to have you here on the podcast. Now, carbon capture technologies feature in many net zero scenarios. Can you perhaps start by defining the key technologies for us?
The topic of reducing the amount of CO2 released into the atmosphere and mitigating climate change is one that is heavily debated today. Carbon capture and storage, or CCS, is one approach that is frequently suggested. Carbon capture and utilization, direct air carbon capture and storage, and bioenergy with carbon capture and storage are frequently debated in the same discussions. CCS refers to a set of technologies that allow CO2 emissions from fossil fuel use at large point sources such as power generation or industrial facilities to be captured and transported to safe geological storage rather than being emitted into the atmosphere. Carbon capture and utilization, CCU, is the process of capturing and recycling CO2 for future utilization. CCS also provides the foundation for technology-based carbon removal, including bioenergy with CCS and direct air carbon capture. Bioenergy with CCS is the method of capturing and permanently storing CO2 from biomass energy generation. Direct air carbon capture and storage is a method of directly collecting CO2 from the atmosphere and producing a concentrated stream of CO2 for sequestration or utilization. The last two approaches could be used to achieve net negative emission, by which we remove more CO2 from the atmosphere than we emit.
Okay, Reza, so are these technologies now accepted as being a critical part of the energy transition within the COP negotiations?
CCS is accepted as a mitigation solution within the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, which notes its explicit recognition in the Kyoto Protocol, the Clean Development Mechanism, the Green Climate Fund, and Technical Expert Meeting. The Paris Agreement is currently the cornerstone of global cooperation on climate change and seeks to hold the increase in the global average temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels and pursue efforts to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Climate change mitigation scenarios consistently indicate that CCS technologies are crucial to reduce atmospheric CO2 emissions in order to limit warming to the agreement's 2-degree and 1.5-degree targets. Despite that, these technologies currently make a much smaller contribution to CO2 mitigation than other mitigation options. Two main areas under the Paris Agreement that could significantly influence these technologies are Article 6 and the global stocktake.
Okay, so how important is Article 6, therefore, and the development of carbon markets in the development of carbon capture technologies?
That's a very good question. Article 6 of the Paris Agreement is widely regarded as a transformative new support mechanism for deploying CCS technologies. As countries voluntarily add these technologies to their nationally determined contributions, or NDCs, the push to integrate them into market mechanisms will increase. Article 6 lays the groundwork for countries to work together to fulfill their climate objectives by allowing emission reductions and removals in one country to be exchanged and credited towards the target of another. The architects of Article 6 anticipated two paths for this cooperation. One, through decentralized forms of cooperation, such as linkages between various national trading systems under Article 6.2, and another through a centralized UN-run pathway for countries lacking the capacity to implement trading approaches domestically, which is under Article 6.4. After years of tense talks, the rules for Article 6 were finally established at COP26. There will be a large amount of intersessional work, requests for technical papers, and workshops in the weeks ahead on the way to Sharm el-Sheikh. These should be able to help nations come to an agreement on Article 6.2 and 6.4 at COP27. Governments will, in fact, need to catch up to a thriving global voluntary carbon market in order to participate in this developing market.
So, Reza, to finish, you know, are you hopeful that COP27 can provide further momentum? Or, you know, is there a risk that political distractions and criticism from environmental NGOs could actually slow progress?
In view of the fact that around 85% of energy demand is currently met by fossil fuels, the rationale behind CCS is to keep fossil fuels in the energy mix while reducing the emissions of CO2 into the atmosphere. One of the most effective and cheapest methods of reducing CO2 emissions into the atmosphere is CCS technology, which is universally acknowledged. Those who are against CCS technologies should note that it is absolutely the pragmatic way of looking at climate change mitigation that brings us to the concepts of CCS and carbon negative technologies, as they allow for the ongoing use of fossil fuels with the added benefit of trapping the carbon emitted during their combustion and re-sequestering it in the lithosphere. All parties and environmental NGOs should bear in mind that a set of mitigation options ought to be utilized in order to tackle climate change. These options are selected based on scientific facts, as well as taking into account the different interests and circumstances of countries. CCS technologies must rely on technically sound, developed, and understood components. I think at COP27, parties should seriously examine CCS technologies in order to achieve their obligations. However, this is highly dependent on other issues that will be discussed at COP27. Such as $100 billion annual climate finance that developed countries were supposed to deliver each year from 2020 to 2025, post-2025 climate financing, the implementation of Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, the launch of the carbon market mechanism among countries and at the global level, an effective phase down of coal and fossil fuels, and the global stocktake dialogues.
Thank you, Reza, very much indeed for that. You know, good summary of the key issues, which, of course, we are covering in other parts of the OIES COP27 podcast series.
We would like to thank all our interviewees for their time and their excellent contributions to the October 2022 edition of the Oxford Energy Forum, which is called COP27, Refocusing the World on the Energy Transition Agenda. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.